from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of this year's Holiday Jazz Showcase.
I'll find out about this year's Arts at All Saints series.
And I'll chat with Indiana Authors Award winner Susan Neville. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. This year's Holiday Jazz Showcase is set for Thursday, November 19th at the Madam Walker Theater. Last year's sellout crowd enjoyed great music, great food, great auctions, and a great time. This year, the Indianapolis Jazz Foundation will be inducting their 2009 Hall of Fame members and paying tribute to great Indianapolis performers, including Wes Montgomery, Mary Moss, and others. Performers this year include the Steve Ali Trio, Cynthia Lane, Brenda Williams, and Bill Langton. Travis DiNicola spoke with Bill Langton about the show.
Bill, it almost seems unfair to you guys that the Holiday Showcase is coming up now. I mean, I know it seems like just yesterday Jazz Fest was
going on. It's been pretty busy. It was a wild summer with Jazz Fest, and of course the Jazz Foundation partnered up to present Jazz Fest. So we were very busy with that, and that just ended in the end of September, and we shifted gears immediately to our showcase in November here.
Well, the Jazz Fest was the first time you guys had been directly involved in presenting this, but the Holiday Jazz Showcase, you've been doing this for years.
The Holiday Showcase started probably at the Jazz Kitchen, 15 years ago probably, and then moved to the Vogue, and really for about the last 10 years or so, it's been at the Madam Walker Theater.
And it is such a great night. I wasn't at the first ones, but I was at when I was at the Vogue and stuff, and now at Madam Walker. And it just, you guys do a great job of bringing together, I mean, so many different jazz talents from around the city, all doing, you know, sort of samples of, well, holiday-related songs, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's sort of the idea, right?
Exactly, yeah. And usually everybody that gets asked, you know, to participate, you know, jumps at the chance, and we just have a really good time. It benefits the foundation, and for people who don't know what the Jazz Foundation does, the Jazz Foundation is a nonprofit organization that basically its mission is to promote the legacy of jazz and promote the future of jazz in Indianapolis through education, working with kids in schools, doing clinics and concerts in schools. So this is our big fundraiser for the year, and most of the musicians, if they're available, want to participate and help out.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's a lot of fun for everybody, too, especially near the end of the evening when there's always, like, the big holiday jam.
Yeah, right.
So give me a bit of the lineup as far as who, you know, has been invited, who's expected. Are there any, you know, sort of themes or tributes going on this year?
There are, actually. One of the big tributes this year is to Mary Moss, and Mary Moss has been a big part of the Holiday Showcase from the beginning, and we decided that this year we were going to actually take time and give her a tribute. She's worked so hard to help us out. So in that vein, we're going to have Cynthia
Lane. Mary's a vocalist who's been around
absolutely
for
Mary
a long
Moss, yeah.
time. Yeah.
Yep. Mary's going to be there, and we're going to have Cynthia Lane's going to perform, do a tribute to Mary. Brenda Williams is going to be there to do a tribute. I think Everett Green is going to be there to do a tribute. The Steve Ali Trio is going to be the house band with Steve Ali on piano, Greg Archie on drums, and Jesse Whitman on bass. And I'm sure that I'll pick up a guitar and do a couple of tunes myself.
Nice. Okay. Very cool. So, who else? Any sense of other musicians that are signing up or coming in? Or
well, we also have. As part of the program, we have our induction into the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm. And this is something you've been doing pretty much every year about the past 10 years or so, I think?
Ever since the beginning, really.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so this year we have a great class coming in. A few guys have been around from Indiana Avenue days, Al Coleman, Reggie Duvall, and Bill Pennick. And then Tommy Wills is coming in, and great bass player Frank Smith, who's a little younger than everybody else, but he's paid his dues here, and he certainly belongs in there. So I think Frank's going to play. You know, Tommy will probably play. And then we also are giving out our scholarships this year to four students. And there'll be a few of those that'll play. And I'm not sure that all of them will play, but there'll be some student play
now
performances
these,
also.
High school, college students?
Yeah, these are college students.
College students, mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And again, so, you know, part of the work that the foundation does is benefit that sort of education
mm-hmm.
programming.
Exactly, yeah.
As well.
And we go to the, basically we go to the jazz music directors at the area schools like Marion,
mm-hmm.
University of Indianapolis, IEPUI, and we pretty much leave it up to the directors, music directors, to choose who are the students that are worthy of the, you know, receiving the scholarships.
Okay. Now, I know that the doors open at 6.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bar. There's also, is there dinner involved? Or?
There is. Mm-hmm. There is, yep. There's a buffet. Jugs Catering is putting it on again,
nice.
Which is wonderful. And it's included with the price, $25 at the door. There is a bar, cash bar, also available. Doors open at 6, and the music starts at 6:30.
Music at 6:30, yeah. And then just keeps on going throughout
keeps
the night.
Keeps on going, yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
Wonderful.
Stuff. Now for you, Bill, you know, are there favorite holiday songs that you just really like to play? I mean, I know there's, you know, I'm sure by the time you get to, you know, December 26th, there's a bunch you're tired of. But, you know, this time of year, it's still kind of fresh. So,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I like, first of all, the Christmas song that was written by Mel Torme, I think is probably my all-time
mm-hmm.
favorite, made famous by Nat King Cole. My Favorite Things is another favorite of mine. And you know, I grew up with all the old Andy Williams and Johnny Mathis and
mm-hmm.
all the old Christmas albums. So I love Christmas music. But like you said, I'm sure, you know, by December 26th, I'll be ready to move on.
Right. But at this point, it's still kind of, you know, everyone's kind of yeah. into it and excited about it. And stuff,
well, so. And it's funny because I do so much teaching and
mm-hmm.
My students all, you know, starting in around October,
yeah.
they're all like, oh, can we work on some Christmas stuff? So I've actually been playing Christmas tunes for the last month with them. And it's funny because pretty much every year I have to almost relearn them because you really only play them a few times and then
mm-hmm.
you put them away for 11 months or whatever. But, yeah, it's great music.
Do you think there's some, an affinity between sort of jazz music and Christmas tunes, just in that, you know, with Christmas tunes, everybody knows them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, so much of jazz is being able to improvise, you know, off of what's known. And so, you know, do Christmas songs sort of lend themselves to, you know, just facilitating, you know, a way for people to even, you know, maybe appreciate jazz more?
Yeah. Well, I think any tune, in the history of jazz, jazz really became popular doing the popular songs of the day. So the Great American Songbook of the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s was really the vehicle for jazz artists to take those songs and interpret them. And when you look at Christmas music, it's basically the same thing. A lot
yeah.
of it is Irving Berlin, and you know it's
part
of the Great American Songbook.
Sure.
So it's they are definitely wonderful vehicles, and they're. A lot of them are extremely well written. You know, White Christmas, the Christmas song. I mean, they're written with fabulous chord changes that, you know, lend themselves to great improvisation. So it's they're wonderful tunes to work with.
Very fun. Now the Jazz Foundation, of course, Jazz Fest is a pretty big deal. The Holiday Jazz Showcase is pretty big. But what else do you guys do throughout the year? And can people get involved even if they're not musicians? Correct.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the foundation really, our primary source of funding is through memberships, and we are in a big membership drive now, as you guys have just finished.
Oh, yeah.
But that's our, you know, we do several fundraising events during the year,
mm-hmm.
but really getting involved as a member. And by, you know, being involved as a member, you have the opportunity. We had members that were out at Jazz Fest that had an opportunity to volunteer and come in and see Jazz Fest. So there's a lot of great opportunities. We have volunteers that are going to be working at the showcase. There are perks that you get from joining, like discounts at different shows at Madam Walker and Jazz Kitchen, stuff like that. So really, the best thing to do is to visit our website, www.indianapolisjazz.org, and you can get all kinds of information on that and email us about becoming a member.
Very cool. And now for the Holiday Jazz Showcase, again, tickets are available at the door. Can people get tickets ahead of time as well? Or?
Yeah, actually, go to the website and there'll be information there. We will probably have tickets available this week and next week at the Jazz Kitchen and at the Madam Walker.
Very cool. And Bill, what about you? What are you got coming up for the holidays?
Busy.
Playing everywhere and anywhere.
Yeah, just working about six times this week, and a lot of stuff going on. Great time of year, you know, doing a lot of returning shows that I do, like for different companies that are having, you know, Christmas parties and holiday parties, and so it's been busy.
Great. Well, you know, I'm glad that the holidays are good to jazz musicians in town. Bill, thanks a lot for coming in to Art of the Matter. Always great to see you.
Yeah, wonderful being here. Thanks a lot.
Travis DiNicola with jazz musician Bill Langton. The Indianapolis Jazz Foundation's Holiday Showcase takes place on Thursday, November 19th at the Madam Walker. Doors open at 6 p.m. For more information, visit IndieJazzFoundation.org. Again, IndieJazzFoundation.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Since 1990, All Saints Episcopal Church has offered a series of cultural events free to the Indianapolis community regardless of their faith. This year's Arts at All Saints series has a decidedly modern flair, as Sharon Gamble learned when she stepped into our studio recently with Jason Overall, choir master and organist for the church at 16th and Central on the near north side of Indianapolis.
Well, I love that you're starting your series by celebrating the feast day of the patron saint of, I always heard her as the patron saint of music, not just musicians.
I believe that's right.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's the patron saint of music.
Same thing, right?
By tradition, Saint Cecilia created the world's first organ. So that's part of the mythology of it, and so it's singularly appropriate that we have an organ recital on St. Cecilia's Day.
Absolutely. And a young organist who won the 2009, this year's Young Artist Competition held by the Indianapolis chapter of the American Guild of Organists. You weren't one of the adjudicators of that, were you?
No, but it took place, the competition took place at All Saints Church.
Ah.
And we had three young artists, and it was a very strong panel, and I think the judges had a very difficult time choosing. But in the end, it was a unanimous decision in Mason's favor.
That's a good problem to have. So Mason Copeland, do we know the repertoire? I know he's going to have a broad span of works.
I emailed him and have not heard back yet.
No worries. We know it's going to be a nice tour through the range of the fabulous organ at your church. Your January 17th offering features pianist Ann O'Brien and the Alexander String Quartet. Who are the Alexander String Quartet members?
They're four women that are local, or at least have local roots. One of them is now pursuing a doctorate at the Cincinnati Conservatory, the cellist. But there are a group of four musicians that have played together for a number of years. Ann O'Brien has played with them quite a bit. She's also a parishioner of All Saints Church.
And on the program, a beloved piece that nobody should ever pass up the opportunity to hear live, the Schumann Quintet, and then a work by you.
Yes.
How long have you been writing?
I've been writing music for most of my life, and actually my degrees, both undergraduate and graduate degrees, are in composition. This is a work that I completed just about a year and a half ago.
And I know you, we certainly know that you play organ. Do you play piano as well?
I've had piano lessons. I don't fancy myself any kind of pianist. So the piano part, I think, is probably It's easy enough that I can play it, so I hope that it's not too much of a challenge. Anne O'Brien's a very fine pianist. I think she's had no trouble with it.
Sure. And would you say that your... How would you characterize your writing style? In this piece, anyway.
In this piece, I hope that it is very accessible, first and foremost. I hope that people can relate to everything that's going on. I try to be very open-handed. It is not in a key... So it is not in the same sort of tonal structure that you would expect from Schumann or Mozart or Bach, but I hope it's something that's very easily understood even on the first hearing. It's tonal in the sense that it has a very definite home base, and it moves away from a home and returns you back there, and I think that that sense through the piece is very clear, both on smaller levels and on a larger arc.
Hmm. I love, one of the things I love about your music programming is that you do expand and step forward into current music more than a lot of churches do.
And that's probably some because of my interest in music composition and my own bias there. We do tend to push towards the two limits. We've done a fair amount of early music, which we will continue with our event partnering with Pilgrim Arts and doing music of Henry Purcell, welcoming the local group Echoing Air, and then also a lot of contemporary music as well.
Mm-hmm.
Past spring concerts with our choir, we have done things, we have done programs of music by Benjamin Britten and Arvo Pärt, so both 20th century and contemporary composers.
Fabulous choices. Before you step back for Purcell, you have a nod to St. Valentine's Day, which happens to be on a Sunday this year, Sunday, February 14th. The Juliet letters, Juliet as in Romeo and Juliet?
That's exactly right. We have tried to have lighter events on the Sunday before Ash Wednesday in sort of a nod towards Mardi Gras.
Sure.
And this year, the Sunday before Ash Wednesday happens to be on the 14th of February. So we decided to take the confluence of those two events and do something a little more offbeat. And our hope is to present something that will be a lot of fun, very celebratory, a little lighthearted, and maybe even a little offbeat or... less than sacred, even. And we're going
what?
To have...
I'm shocked.
And so we will have this presentation of a song cycle that was a collaboration originally with Elvis Costello and the Brodsky Quartet. They've been very cagey about exactly where all of the composition came from, saying that it was really a group effort, not by committee, but by a total group. They are... The songs are original poetry and original music to those five musicians, and they're very interesting, and it's a very thought-provoking work as well as being very engaging. And we're going to follow that event with a festive dessert, chocolate, wine reception that we hope will attract a lot of people and get them into the mood of both Valentine's Day and Mardi Gras.
And you've lured Stephen Stolin in as your tenor in this recital.
Exactly. He's very excited about it. He had known of the work, had never heard it, and is very, he's really jumping in with both feet, and we're really excited. I think his voice and his stage presence are going to be just perfect for this fairly dramatic song cycle, and we're really excited about his presence on our series.
You know, I might have to Google this, but this might be the only time I've heard Episcopalian and Elvis Costello in the same sentence.
Well, it could be, but of course he's a good Englishman.
Oh, well, so good point.
I think that the roots run very deep.
Yeah, okay. Anglican musician, we've just elevated Mr. Costello to a whole different interpretation. And you don't have to have a date to come to this. I should specify this.
Exactly.
Okay.
We welcome couples, groups, and singles of all description.
Very good. That's always encouraging. Okay, Echoing Air is Indianapolis-based. Tell us about them.
It is a group that was really fostered by another Stephen, Stephen Rickards, who's a countertenor who sings at Christ Church Cathedral and also teaches at University of Indianapolis and does a lot of teaching. And he has a student that he has really become a big believer in and is started thinking about how he might promote this young artist. And then also in his collaboration at Christ Church Cathedral with David Sinden, became very interested in having an opportunity for sort of a homecoming of friends. So the group will include the two countertenors as well as David Sinden and Tom Gerber providing continuo, mm-hmm. And Timberlake and Jeffrey Collier on flutes.
That's an interesting combination, two countertenors, two flutes, and continuo.
Exactly, yeah. It's a great ensemble, and they've actually been, in their debut year, have already been touring very successfully. They've had some very successful performances in Florida and have been getting a lot of good feedback, and so this will be a very exciting opportunity for us to present them here in their hometown.
Yeah, good deal. And sometimes I think we think back to earlier music like Henry Purcell, and we think staid and very dignified, and sometimes that's true, but not always.
Exactly. Henry Purcell had a very varied career. He wrote for the church, he wrote for court events, but he also wrote tavern songs, some which are fairly lewd, actually. And I think that Stephen's hope for this program is to really provide a wide sampling of the different compositional talent that Henry Purcell had.
Well, one way we know that it's time to turn the calendar and start working in the garden is your spring organ recital, which is going to happen on April 18th. It's probably a little too soon to know the repertoire for that yet, right?
Exactly. It's Derek Nichols, who's in the Chicago area and is a very active recitalist, and we're very excited to give him an opportunity to come down to from the Windy City down to the Circle City and present his talent.
And then well, it's not a climax because all of the concerts are interesting, but the Music of the New Century concert on May 2nd, all music, not just contemporary music in the broad sense, because you say contemporary classical music and people think, within the last century. This is within the last decade.
Exactly. We have, for the past several years, ended each year's season with a presentation by the All Saints Choir. And we've divided those pretty fairly between historical repertoire and more contemporary repertoire. In thinking about as we draw to a close of the first decade of the 21st century and the great wealth of choral literature that is being written in our time, we decided that this would be a good opportunity to show how vital the tradition is and how vibrant the young talent that we have with us. And so our hope is to present a program of music that has been written in the past decade that people will love.
I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you because
this will not be an esoteric concert.
This is it sounds like such a challenge, but what's so interesting is as a music programmer, is dealing with music that's in an era that hasn't been categorized yet.
Exactly.
You know, I wish we could get in the fast-forward machine and go a century from now and discover that the first quarter of the 21st century is the new romanticism or whatever. We just don't know yet. There's no one thing that defines us yet.
And I would actually say that composers that are working now, and including composers that we're going to feature, are actually thriving by not being categorized, and they're being able to be a little more free with their compositional style because they're not pigeonholed and they're not locked into preconceived ideas. We'll be doing some music by Tarik O'Regan, who has not in any way been catering to public taste, but has been writing in styles that are very much picking up on popular trends in music. We'll also be doing some music by Andrew Smith, who is another Englishman who is working in Scandinavia, is very interested in the resurgence of plain song and the renewed interest in Gregorian
really?
Chant.
Huh.
But juxtaposing that with something that is very clearly of our own time. So I think we're going to be able to show people how unscary
don't be afraid.
Music of the 21st century really is.
Are some of the people you've had to reassure your own singers?
Not so much. It's a pretty adventuresome group, and I think because they have had a lot of patients working with me, and I've subjected them to probably more of my writing than I should have, I think they're just happy to see well-crafted contemporary music.
Oh, no, don't insult yourself like that. Hey, there are lots of great composers in the past who did exactly that. What a fabulous laboratory you have.
Right.
So why not take advantage?
It's a great group of musicians, and I've been able to take advantage of that as well. It's fun to get to write music where you're not so constrained by technical limitations, and writing for this group has been a very liberating experience for me.
Sharon Gamble with Jason Overall, choirmaster and organist of All Saints Episcopal Church, 1559 Central Avenue, Indianapolis. That's right at Central and 16th Street. You can learn more about arts at All Saints at allsaintsindy.org. Again, allsaintsindy.org. Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
You know, we've talked before about how people can get their events on our calendar.
Yes.
And all they have to do is, you know, go to the WFYI website
mm-hmm.
and find the Art of the Matter page under, you know, local programs under radio.
Uh-huh.
And there's a place there you can submit information and stuff.
Uh-huh.
We actually got a submission from a fan, though, that I have to read.
Okay.
Yeah. So from last week, your program is fantastic. I've learned about the quantity and quality of arts in Indianapolis. Two Saturdays ago, while listening to the show, I changed my direction. While I was driving, turned the car around and visited the IMA. Thanks from Linda Kratz. So thank you,
that's
Linda.
Fabulous.
Isn't that
cool? Oh,
so,
man.
Sharon, our challenge today is to come up with things on our calendar that make people want to turn their car around. You ready?
Oh, yeah.
It's that thing we call
What Will We do? Whatever you do, drive safely and don't make a U-turn where one's not allowed. Actually, you don't have to change your direction on my first event until Monday evening. That's
oh,
the
you got
16th.
Plenty of time then.
Yeah, plenty of time. You can actually plan ahead. On Monday the 16th, you might point your vehicle in the direction of the Ruth Lilly Performance Hall at the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center. Yes, that's a mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
To hear Kilo, that's Frank Glover's jazz ensemble. You maybe are accustomed to hearing them on Monday nights at the Jazz Kitchen. Well, on Monday the 16th at 7:30, they're going to be at the DeHaan Center. And they're going to feature some pieces from their upcoming Owl Studios release called Abacus. And their influences are all over the place, all the way from Astor Piazzolla to Toru Takemitsu, fusion, electronica, all high energy, all great modern jazz. Kilo, Monday night at the DeHaan at 7:30.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on Saturday night, with performances both at 6 and 9:30, so you can sort of head your car there if it's Saturday afternoon, Standards, Broadway, and Everything in Between, featuring Broadway star Natalie Toro down at the Connoisseur Room, the American Cabaret. Really great place to hear great singers, and Natalie Toro has been in so many wonderful shows in Les Mis and Christmas Carol, Evita, Cats, Jesus Christ Superstar, and she's also been doing a solo show at New York's Metropolitan Room, and that's the show that she is bringing to Indianapolis. So that's down at the Connoisseur Room, Saturday, 6 and 9:30, Natalie Toro.
Wow, that's quite a resume.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a little quiz. Speaking of great classic tunes, name a singer who was famous for and had big hits with the following tunes: Stranger in the Night, That Old Black Magic, Fly Me to the Moon, I've Got You Under My Skin, I Only Have Eyes for You.
Well, it's got to be Old Blue Eyes.
I was going to say, and here's the clincher, My Way. It's mm-hmm. Old Blue Eyes, and he is the subject of a beautiful tribute called My Way, a musical tribute to Frank Sinatra. This is Actors Theater of Indiana, and they are performing through this weekend, through Sunday, at the New Carmel Community Playhouse at Clay Terrace. More information available at actorstheaterofindiana.org, actorstheaterofindiana.org.
Very cool. Hey, Spirit in Place wraps things up this weekend, continuing with events Friday night, all day Saturday. You can check out the Spirit in Place website for more information. But the big event on Sunday, the finale, Bill Hudnut and John Fetterman, A Public Conversation. And, of course, Bill Hudnut was the four-term mayor of Indianapolis, and Fetterman is the mayor of a he's sort of this big, tattooed, bald-headed kind of hipster mayor from Braddock, Pennsylvania. And so they'll be talking
together.
One of these
things is not like the other.
Exactly. Should be interesting. That takes place from 3:30 to 5:30 on Sunday, the public conversation for Spirit in Place.
By the way, I hear that people still stop Bill Hudnut when he's in town and ask him about the Blizzard of 78,
the mythic
which happened during his watch. Yeah. That's right. Actually, probably the children conceived during the Blizzard of 78 are now asking him about that. Hey, you can put your hands in clay.
Cool.
Why not, right?
Okay, sure.
It's Clay 101 with Instructor Don Edwards. Children ages 6 and up, and that would include you and me, Travis, can sit at a potter's wheel and learn some of the basics of working with clay. It's a program that's taking place all around the city at Indianapolis Marion County Public Library branches. And you can find out more by going to imcpl.org. That stands for Indianapolis Marion County Public Library.org. They encourage you to pre-register so that they will have enough clay and potting wheels available.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Hey, I want to give a happy anniversary to Additions Limited Gallery in Broad Ripple. It's their 40th anniversary, which is really fantastic. So Additions Limited Gallery is celebrating their 40th anniversary with a party on Friday the 20th from 5 to 9 with cake and champagne and another opening reception for the great work that they show there. It's a really neat place. And where else can you see, like, you know, some Andy Warhol and Picasso and Miro, as well as local artists? So check that out in Broad Ripple.
Excellent. Hey, there's something old and something very new on the docket next Wednesday. That's November 18th at 7:30, as the Ensemble Music Society presents the St. Lawrence String Quartet. The Old is one of the great works. If you've never heard it performed live, get yourself there to hear the Beethoven Quartet in C-sharp minor, Opus 131. This is the great, overarching, just absolutely the most spiritual thing you have ever heard, quartet. The new piece on the program is a string quartet by John Adams, composed for the St. Lawrence String Quartet in 2008. So very, very, very new. And that will be taking place at the Basile Theater at the Indiana History Center next Wednesday, the 18th at 7:30, St. Lawrence String Quartet.
It was another anniversary, actually. Luna Music. I love Luna.
Luna
loves me. Luna Music is celebrating their 15th anniversary, and they're having an event with a Big Car Gallery down in Fountain Square. And it's an evening with Mark Kozelek. And if you're a fan of the music of Red House Painters or Sun Kill Moon, I love Red House Painters, and Sun Kill Moon's really cool stuff. That's all Kozelek stuff. And he'll be performing that as well as some of his solo material. And they're only doing 100 tickets for this concert. So if you're a fan and you get an opportunity to meet him, and you get a silkscreen poster and all types of cool stuff.
Cool.
But you have to get your tickets through Luna. First come, first serve. And the concert takes place on Friday, the 11th of December, down at Big Car Gallery. But go to Luna for more information.
Very cool. Speaking of music, as the days grow shorter, Encore Vocal Arts has put together a concert called The Power of Light. It will be, forgive the pun, bringing to light songs from the Underground Railroad all the way to contemporary works. The Power of Light will be presented by Encore Vocal Arts at St. Joan of Arc Catholic Church on Saturday, November 21st at 8 o'clock. That's St. Joan of Arc on Saturday, November 21st, 8 o'clock. The Power of Light by Encore Vocal Arts. More information at encorevocalarts.org.
Very good. Well, Sharon, there is so much more. There's a lot, so much stuff as people are gearing up for the holidays.
Absolutely.
And, of course, we'll be able to talk more about them next week and maybe even turn a few more cars around when we come back with
What Will We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Author Susan Neville recently won the regional award in the first Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award competition. Neville is the author of 5 works of creative nonfiction, 2 collections of short fiction, and has had her work appear in numerous magazines and anthologies. She lives in Indianapolis, and when she isn't writing, teaches writing at Butler. Travis DiNicola spoke with her about her work and what this prize means to her.
Susan, welcome to Art of the Matter.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on winning the regional award in the Indiana Authors Competition. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was very exciting. I mean, I think it was an exciting event.
I was there that night.
Were you there?
And you
that
looked
night?
Awfully surprised and thrilled. And
I was completely surprised.
Yeah.
I mean, you spend a lot of time, you know, you spend your life writing, and I was so thrilled when I even heard that there was going to be this award, because it's always seemed to me that the literary arts, despite the fact that James Whitcomb Riley has the highest and best real estate in Indianapolis, are sometimes forgotten. So I know that the entire writing community was excited about these awards and excited that they're, you know, going to be ongoing. And I have such incredible respect for the other finalists in the awards. So I was surprised and excited, and I felt as though I'm accepting it for all of us.
Yeah, well, yeah. It definitely felt that way, especially for the inaugural ones. And for listeners who may not be familiar with it, the Indiana Author Awards, this is actually Eugene and Marilyn Glick have sponsored this. They've been working with the Library Foundation, the Indianapolis Marion County Library Foundation, to create this competition.
Right.
And there were 3 awards given. There was sort of the national, the regional, and the emerging, and so you got to be regional.
I got to be regional, and I was very, very happy. The other candidates were Jared Carter, who I think is just an incredible poet, and James Madison, who's an incredible writer and historian. So it was great to be with everyone that day.
Yeah,
it was very festive.
It was a wonderful event. I was fortunate enough, I got to interview the national winner, James Alexander Thom, beforehand. So that was very exciting, too. And, of course, now he knew going into it that he had won.
He did.
But the rest of you did not.
The rest of us had no idea. And, at the end, that we had our names on a little piece of chocolate, which was exciting. Your entire life you've wanted to have your name in chocolate, so... It was exciting. It was a great day.
Now let me ask you. With these awards, they're honoring both people who live and work in Indiana, as well as other people who've perhaps started here but live somewhere else. But to some extent, there's got to be a connection. Sometimes the connection's with the work itself. A lot of your writing, both fiction and nonfiction, I believe, is about the Midwest.
It is.
Is that correct? Tell me about why it is that you think that you got the award.
Oh, that's a really good question. I guess if I knew, I wouldn't have been surprised. I've been writing about the Midwest and Indiana in particular for 20, 30 years, and I write fiction and nonfiction, and I'm really committed to writing about this place and to living in it as well as writing about it. And so I'm not sure. I'm working in it and teaching in it,
certainly. I mean,
right.
You know, and one thing that I mentioned before we start our interview is that it's certainly not unusual to meet writers who are also teachers. And I've been very fortunate to interview many writers who also teach writing. What I think is unusual, as I was thinking back on many authors who I've had a chance to interview, is that they're usually, in most cases, known for being either fiction writers or nonfiction. Now, certainly there are some who cross over, but you seem to be almost sort of equally divided as I was looking through your list of works and the work that you're known for.
I think that's true. I go back and forth between fiction and nonfiction, and that's been a productive way to do my career. I think in part because, when I first moved back to Indiana when I was younger, And I was writing fiction primarily. It was before the creative nonfiction boom. And I used to write essays now and then, and I would send them out. And people would say, we don't publish nonfiction. No one was publishing literary essays at that time. But after I had been living here for a while, I kind of ran out of things to write about. I mean, I ran out of things that where I could just be kind of in my room going into my imagination, you know.
Did you find you were inserting essays into your short stories?
Not really. I just felt as though I didn't know enough.
Okay.
You know, I just didn't know enough people, didn't know enough about the place. And so I was asked to write an essay, and the experience was so exciting to me because it was, I don't know if you remember when Ibn Browning predicted that there would be an earthquake in the Midwest, and probably don't. It was in the early 90s.
Okay,
and
before I moved here.
Yeah, before you moved here, but people believed it.
Mm-hmm.
And so schools were closing. My students that day said they weren't going to come to school because they were afraid that bridges were going to fall down and things
like that.
So I decided to go down to New Harmony, Indiana, and write about where the epicenter of the earthquake was supposed to be and write about that day. So it was just so exciting to walk through the town and talk to people who, you know, not at all. I mean, it was one of those incredibly wonderful group delusional systems, like, you know, Y2K or, you know, one of those things where it's sort of fun to watch everyone kind of create this group narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't for a second believe that it was going to happen. It was fun. And everyone who was out that day, we were all the agnostics, you know, we were like non-earthquake believers. So I interviewed people in stores and they told me stories about, you know, they had friends who had tied their hot water heaters to their wall with cup hooks, and all the insurance companies were writing earthquake riders and things like that. And I got really hooked into writing nonfiction then.
Yeah.
So I realized that I could live the rest of my life in Indiana and go out into small towns and into the country and into factories and into historical societies, and I would never run out of material, ever. So that's when I started writing nonfiction, and I always felt as though I brought the same skills, scene setting and dialogue and things to the nonfiction as to the fiction. And the great thing that happens is that I'll get stuck in the nonfiction, and then I'll go back to fiction. So it's kind of moving between the two genres has been really productive for me.
Are you usually working on two things at once?
I usually am working on two things at once. When I did Fabrication, the book of Indiana factories, I was almost completely engrossed in the nonfiction, which is usually the case. I'll be engrossed in a nonfiction project and writing stories as they occur to me. And then right now I'm writing a lot of fiction and getting ready to write more nonfiction next year. So I'm kind of always thinking ahead and doing primarily one at one time, but dipping into the other at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I'm wondering if your the mechanics in some way are the same or different in terms of as you go back and rewrite, as you craft your work, do you find yourself, you know, I certainly many writers have different regimens that they stick to as far as when they write or how many pages, and then when they go back and correct the work or edit it. Do you do the same thing with both nonfiction and fiction, or is that different?
They feel exactly the same when I'm writing. I mean, the crafting of them feels exactly the same, with the exception, in some ways there's more. You would think this wouldn't be true, but it feels as though there's more freedom in the nonfiction because you're free to suddenly stop and say, I wonder what Nietzsche would think about this. Or, you know, you can kind of go off on tangents and things like that. So the process is similar. The big difference is that when I'm writing nonfiction, I often will set up a schedule where I'm going out into the field 1 week and then writing about it and doing research the next. Mm-hmm. And then the week after that, I'll be going out in the field someplace else and then coming back and writing and doing research. So that's the difference.
Let's talk about place a little bit, because that seems to be a big part of your nonfiction work, the exploration of place. And one of the titles of your book has the phrase, the Inland Sea.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Sailing the Inland Sea, I love titles.
Sailing the Inland
Sailing
Sea.
Sailing the Inland Sea. Yeah, the Inland Sea is a collection of essays that is about the Inland Sea of the imagination, and also, you know, the idea that the Midwest was once covered by a vast Inland Sea, and also the Inland Sea of the Great Lakes. And I just, I like titles that have three or four different layers of meaning, and that unfortunately a lot of times mean nothing to anyone else, and then so they can't find them on Amazon. But that particular collection, I was writing about writers who wrote about the Midwest, who are from, in particular, Indiana, and how the Midwestern imagination works, and connecting the Inland Sea of the imagination to the Inland Sea of the landscape. So
how does the Midwestern imagination
work? I knew you were going to ask that as soon as I said that. I don't know. I mean, I've read a lot of essays by, of fiction and poetry by Indiana writers, and looked at how Indiana writers, you know, thought about landscape. And there was a great collection of Indiana writers a few years ago called The Landlocked Heart. And I think, I think that sense of being landlocked, the sense of, I mean, it's today we've, you know, changed daylight savings time, so it's now grayer and darker earlier, that has an effect on the way we view the place we live, the way we write about it. It has an effect on our moods, the colors, you know, that are in a kind of landlocked, formerly swampy area.
Sure.
You know, they're more subtle. The sky, when it's really, really blue here, is gorgeous, but muted. I mean, if you were to look at a color fan deck, you know, of paint, you would pick our colors from the muted end of the spectrum.
Well, I'm
and
convinced
so,
the clouds
you know,
are different
really
here, honestly.
I think it has something to do with the dampness. I mean, it's, you know, with the fact that this used to be a swamp in a really kind of vast inland forest. And so, I don't know, it's interesting. It's something to think about.
Let me ask you about the work that you do at Butler. You teach writing at Butler.
I do.
Fiction and nonfiction, or?
I do. I teach fiction and nonfiction, creative writing, and then I also do some seminars, usually in fiction. So, well, I've done both over the years, but my passion, I guess, is Willa Cather. I love teaching Willa Cather's novels and stories, and Flannery O'Connor and Chekhov. So I get to teach fiction and teach and write nonfiction as well.
Excellent. When you're teaching writing, other than, you know, write what you know, I mean, what do you talk to your students about? That especially, you know, I mean, you know, young college students who are aspiring to get their thoughts on paper, who want to write but don't know what to write about, don't even know where to start. What do you suggest to them?
I always I suggest two things to students. One is one of my favorite quotes is Flannery O'Connor, who said that learning to write is learning to see. And so, I mean, this doesn't, you know, sometimes you think that means that students need to write realistic fiction, and many of my students some of my students do, and some of my students aren't interested in writing realism at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that even if you're writing about, a planet that doesn't even exist, that becoming aware of what you see and of being able, whether it's what you see in your imagination or in the world around you, that learning that fiction and nonfiction and poetry as well are built out of concrete details and sensory description and much of that in order for it not to come right out of what you just saw on TV. It has to come from observation and from kind of a really careful observation. And the other thing is I think that writers learn by reading other writers and reading them carefully and reading them at a sentence level and seeing how another writer accomplished an effect that you would like to accomplish yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask students what their who their favorite writers are, and then point them back to those writers to do close readings and to see what it is, how they did something that, how did they write that dialogue that seemed so mm-hmm. real? How do they go back and forth between setting and dialogue, or how do they create scenes? How do they do plot? It all comes from, I think all writers are readers first.
Travis DiNicola with author Susan Neville, winner of the regional award in the first Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award competition. Her books are available at bookstores everywhere.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll find out what's making history at the Indiana History Center.
And I get to chat with Big Bird, about Sesame Street's 40th birthday. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar that we call What'll We Do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.